Hey everyone, what's up? It's Phil Gribishak, and I am just excited as all heck today to talk to Josh Kaufman. Now, Josh is a best-selling author that I've known on the internet since April of 2005, which is 1 month after my blog started. Josh launched a reading list for this personal MBA, which was a bunch of books that you could get instead of going to get your MBA. So the reason I don't have an MBA is all Josh's fault, and I'm grateful for it. Because I learned so much. But we're going to talk today about his new book, How to Fight a Hydra. We're going to talk a little bit about his history. And we're going to talk about what it's like to go between publishing with a traditional publisher, to publishing on your own, doing your own audiobook, and everything in between. So what's up, Josh? I'm glad you're here, man.
Phil, it is an absolute pleasure to be here. And yeah. If I can take even, you know, a fraction of a percent of the credit for unleashing you upon the world, then I'm absolutely happy to.
Well, you're kind, but I mean it, man. I mean, truly, I remember early on when that was possible, because I was really debating, like, boy, I'm a VP of IT, and I'm thinking I should go back to school. And instead, I realized that I would learn a lot more by connecting with smart folks like you and Seth Godin and a bunch of all other smart bald guys that I've learned so much from. And it is it's something that I certainly don't regret, because that personal MBA really did change my life, man. So thank you so much for that.
Absolutely. I mean, for a crazy personal project that I started in my spare time, I had no idea it would amount to anything, let alone this.
That is cool, man. That is cool. So let's talk a little bit about that, right? These crazy projects, sometimes they're the ones that give us the most juice. So why did you even start Personal MBA now 13 and a half years ago?
Yeah, so the Personal MBA was a very personal project. I was just getting out of my undergraduate degree at the University of Cincinnati and was going to work for a huge consumer goods company, Procter & Gamble. So the company that invented brand management, all sorts of different products and all sorts of different categories. And I was going to be doing product development for household care brands. So the first brands I work on were Mr. Clean, Swiffer, Dawn, Cascade, and Febreze. So that most people have kind of heard about. Actually, funny story. I shaved my head after I knew I had the job, but before I knew what brand I was going to be assigned to. And of course, I was assigned to Mr. Clean. And so when I came in, everybody's like, whoa, you're really excited about this job. Like, it was an accident, I promise.
That's cool. And you haven't looked back in hair yet? I mean, that's been the style then for the last 15 years?
It has been. I would never go back. I love it. little bit of maintenance. At some point, I have been intending to write a post on my website about how to shave your head, because I've learned a lot over the years. But it's always been a back burner kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I was at P&G, and long story short, everybody that I was going to be working with on a day-to-day basis had just graduated from a top 15 US MBA program, and I had not. But in the same way, it didn't make any sense for me to quit my job, go back to school, borrow a bunch of money to come back to the job that I already had. I wanted to know the stuff. And so I decided, well before I started full-time, that I had a lot of learning to do. And the best way I knew how to learn all the things that I wanted to know was really digging in and doing a lot of reading and research. So that's when I started effectively reading as a second full-time job. It's probably the best way to frame it. So I would do my schoolwork, and then after I started at the company, I would work all day, and then I would come home and just read. And I went through an enormous amount of material. So in the first, the first 5 years, I had just read hundreds of books. And so the reading list came out of, I found some business books way more useful than others. So there are a lot of business books that are meant to be interesting or entertaining. Or, you know, in the case of very many profiles of CEOs. It's meant as an exercise in personal marketing and, you know, not necessarily maximally useful to the reader. And so I had been going through all of this material, and some books were far and above better at communicating important things about business. And so when I started this project, I went looking for a list of, you know, I want to learn about business. What should I read first? And I couldn't find anything, which seemed really weird to me. And so I decided that, well, you know, I'm doing this project. I should probably put together a list of all the things that I found most useful and put it out there and see if anybody else finds it useful too. And lo and behold, thousands and thousands of readers all over the world found it very useful very quickly. And that was my first sign that I was onto something that was bigger than this personal project that I took on just because I needed it.
Wow. Wow. So you basically wrote a best-selling book for yourself.
Yeah. So, you know, the book came about, I think I was about 5 years into the reading part. And I was originally intending on doing something like a course. So when you read an enormous amount of business material, you start seeing the same ideas come up over and over and over again. And those are the ideas that, frankly, carry most of the weight when it comes to learning what businesses are, how they work, how to create a new one or make an existing one better. You see the same ideas over and over. And so I figured, why not, instead of having all of these very important concepts spread across this huge amount of books and courses and information, instead of having to dig all that out for yourself, what if there was a resource that just told you the important stuff first, so you could establish context on what you were doing quickly, and then everything else that you did and everything else that you read or experimented with after that point would make a lot more sense because you had a solid base of knowledge to understand it with. So that's where the Personal MBA book came from. It was essentially taking all of the most important ideas that I had learned and putting it into the best introductory resource that I could possibly make.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, it's a great book. And the list is great. I mean, the Change This Manifesto is great. I'll throw the Change This Manifesto and link to the book in the show notes, because I think it's important that people take a look at this. It's a, you know, it's really powerful, man, but you got to traditionally publish. So, I mean, you had thousands of people that were passionate about the list and about adding to it and trying to add value back to you and get on there. I mean, the manifesto from the folks at 800 CEO Read, 99 books that you need to read, really, really strong stuff there, super valuable on its own. But then you published the book and you already had a built-in audience. So
right.
I'm going to guess, I mean, that makes a book proposal a whole lot easier, right? If you already have an audience, it's not just a best read or best written book. It's a bestseller, right?
Yeah. So that was factored into a lot of the early conversations. So the Personal MBA was published through what is now Penguin Random House, the portfolio business imprint of Penguin. And a lot of the early conversations was, you know, yeah, I have this idea for a book, and happened to meet Adrian Zackheim, the publisher of Portfolio, at a conference. And we got to talking. He's like, have you ever thought about writing a book about this? I'm like, well, you know, not really, but that sounds like an interesting, useful thing. Let me think about it, and I'll shoot you over what I think that might look like. And so I sent Adrian essentially a long email saying, okay, if I were to do this as a book, here's what I think it might look like. And he came back and you know, had a couple questions and then said, yeah, I want you to meet David Moldauer. He is an acquiring editor here at Portfolio, and we'd love to have a discussion about it. So I met with David, and David is both a wonderful person and a fantastic editor, one of the best business editors working right now. And actually, he's still my editor. He freelance edits books. His company is called Bookitect. And so we sat down for lunch, and he said, you know, yeah, we're interested in this book. Let's talk. And a lot of the early conversations were, this is a strong idea for a business book. There is a built-in demonstrated audience of people who want this stuff. And there's every reason to believe that all of the people who have signed up over the years to follow the progress of this project are probably going to be really jazzed that a book exists. So that's a high probability project. Like, this is something that we think could work. And so, yeah, the early audience was very key in making sure that, you know, writing a book is a huge commitment of ongoing time and energy. It takes a long time and a lot of work to make it happen. And so having confidence that the end result of that is going to be something that will sell and hopefully sell for a long time, that went a really long way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the number one thing that kills a book is no audience. I mean, it doesn't matter how smart your idea is. If you can't sell that book, the publisher's not going to invest any money in it. But you had, I mean, Josh, your first two books were bestsellers, and now you decided to kind of flip into not just out of business, but holy crap, man, you flipped into fiction? Like, you wrote basically a fable. I mean, how to fight a hydra, face your fears, pursue your ambitions, and become the hero you're destined to be, which is quite a departure from where you were. So what got the bee in your bonnet that said, you know, I want to write a fiction book?
So in a sense, it's a departure. Like, the format is very different from anything that I've ever written. But content wise, it's actually less of a departure than it seems. So in talking to readers, and I had a business advising consulting practice for many years. So people, in the process of going through the personal MBA, a lot of the questions that readers and my clients would have is like, I have an idea for a business and it feels super scary and overwhelming. I'm not sure if this is going to work. I'm not sure if it's worth my time. I'm not sure if this is the best thing that I could be doing. This is expensive. I'm going to have to rearrange my life. Like, this just feels like really big and scary. And I don't know if it's a good idea. Can you tell me it's a good idea? Can you tell me it's going to work? And there's no honest way that you can go to somebody and say, yes, absolutely 100% certainty. This is the best possible thing that you could be doing with your life. So there's this undercurrent of uncertainty and risk and fear of the unknown that was present in the vast majority of conversations that I had around the personal MBA. You know, people trying to decide if the thing they're thinking about doing is a good idea. So for First 20 Hours, which is the follow-up book I did on learning new skills quickly, you know, another universal topic we all deal with in some way, shape, or form. And I was hearing a lot of the same types of questions and concerns, like, am I really going to be able to do this? Is this process really going to work for me? Like, maybe it's worked for other people. Is it going to work for me? How do I know that I'm going to get or be good enough at this thing that I want to do? What if there's another thing that I should be learning or would be more valuable to learn that I'm not doing? So, you know, the same themes and again, about uncertainty and risk and fear of the unknown. And so I started, How to Fight a Hydra actually started as a productivity book. I wanted to do essentially what I did for personal MBA, like try to collect all the most important things you should probably understand first. And the more that I wrote several drafts of that book, and the more I sat with it, and I was actually talking about it with David too, the book just wasn't working in the way that I wanted it to work. And when I was thinking about why that might be, I kept coming back to, you know, people don't need yet another way to manage their to-do list. They don't need more tips and tricks. The thing that helps people the most is dealing directly with these big, scary, important concerns at the beginning of any project. You know, so let's examine uncertainty. Let's examine risk. Let's examine fear of the unknown. And are there things that we can learn or understand that maybe won't take them away completely, because those are features of living in the world. It's just a fundamental fact of how we exist in relation to the world around us. But are there things that we can do or ways that we can think that help us deal with the realities? And so I started researching uncertainty and risk and fear in a more direct way. And what I found is when you try to write research-based nonfiction about those topics, you very quickly start reading a book that nobody wants to read because it's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable enough as we're experiencing it in our day-to-day life, but it's really uncomfortable to, you know, sit with research-based nonfiction about fear and risk. And so that's where the idea of making it a metaphor and using the tools of fiction to help illustrate. So instead of explaining the research, it's quite interesting to take a protagonist, put them into a situation that is extremely difficult and something that they know is difficult, something hard that they signed up for, that they want to do. And then you can learn everything you need to learn by watching that protagonist use all of the tools at their disposal in a skillful way. So it's a different way of communicating the same type of insight. It's just a way more engaging, way more interesting way to go about doing it.
That makes a lot of sense. I know Steve Farber's Radical Leap and Radical Edge have been mm-hmm. much the same in how they talk about leadership. And I think it's important that, those fables, instead of following, 37 people through 1 point or 2 points, now we have, to your point, one protagonist that we can follow throughout, kind of get behind and maybe, empathize with, see some of ourselves in, see some of our challenges in, without it being uncomfortable. So I think that's really smart, man. That's a really smart way to do that. Now, let's talk a little bit about the fundamentals there. I mean, how do you actually go about writing a fiction book, Josh? I mean, did you, was there a book that you picked up that helped that? Was this just a natural thing, like flipping from nonfiction business over to fiction? Or what? Talk to us a little bit about that process.
Yeah. So in general, I have often envied fiction writers because if they get stuck, they can just make something up. And that's totally legit. Like you can't really do that in the same way with research-based nonfiction. So that was kind of a fun, refreshing, creative change. Just being able to construct a situation that has all of the parameters of the lessons that you're trying to illustrate through the story. So that part was really fun. In terms of things, models or approaches to the work that worked really well for me. So in general, there is a book called The Story Grid by Sean Coyne.
Oh, yeah.
There's actually an excellent podcast with Sean Coyne and Tim Grawl. I think it's at storygrid.fm, if I'm remembering correctly. Highly recommended. Sean does an excellent job of breaking down the fundamentals of fiction. And so there are certain conventions, expectations, obligatory scenes in the type of fiction material that you're writing. So it helps to understand the type of story you're writing, what needs to be there, and how you need to go about filling any gaps you have. And so, as kind of a meta, here's how to do fiction in a interesting, engaging way, I found StoryGrid extremely helpful. In terms of format, I actually used a nonfiction book, a very old nonfiction book as the model, which is Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. And have you read or do you know much about Meditations?
A little bit, sure. I haven't read it, but I'm familiar with the work.
So the thing that I love about Meditations, so Marcus Aurelius was an emperor of Rome. So literally at the time, the most powerful person in the world. And he kept this journal, and so not intended for publication. It was just, notes to himself about all of the things that he was thinking about and experiencing and struggling with and all of that. And you see, it's a great model for a book about ambition, uncertainty, risk, and fear of the unknown, because you see Marcus Aurelius in the process of writing these notes to himself. You see him struggling with these very mundane, very common day, very modern, in a sense, concerns. And so I thought that as a device, writing notes to yourself, a person experiencing difficult things, and then trying to analyze it and learn from it and figure out what to do next and how to deal with the situations that they're currently experiencing. There's a form of fiction called the epistolary novel. Mm-hmm. So think like Dracula, the it's letters back and forth between a person. So meditations is self-epistolary. It's notes to yourself. And so as a device, it was really interesting because that general format. So the protagonist is an adventurer who is literally setting off to kill a huge monster. And so that general format really allows a lot of introspective writing in a way that's engaging, like the adventurers describing what they go through, but doing it in a way that allows the scope of the story to be reasonably straightforward and small. And so it was great, you know, for this particular application where we're trying to illustrate research-based or time-tested principles that help in these types of situations. It was a really great way of having enough fiction to be able to set up a circumstance where that illustration happens in a straightforward way, without having to use the full artifice of, you know, writing a novel. So huge descriptions of environment and things like that.
Cool. Wow. That's really interesting. That and I would not, you know, well, first, I've never heard the word epistolary before, but then I think back to, you know, my days growing up as a Catholic and hear, you know, the epistles and remember, that's likely where that came from. So got that. So that makes a lot of sense. And I think that self-epistolary, to write letters to yourself, that almost that self-help, help yourself, is a really interesting way to go about things, because it's almost like, so what are all the things I wish I'd known about how to face my fears, which then you can put into this How to Fight a Hydra, which I think is pretty cool, man.
Thanks. Yeah, it ended up working really well, and it took a couple drafts to get there. And so originally, the first full draft that I did of Hydra was 100% retrospective self-epistolary work. So it was the adventurer looking back on a successful career, and it's what are the things that are important and what are the things that I wish I had known. And then it after early readers had read the initial draft, there was a lot of excitement around, well, this is a person who is clearly experienced and has things to say, but the first draft didn't establish any context about, you know, who is this person and why should I listen to them? And so really reframing the book as a journal that was taken on the initial, you know, extremely scary adventure into the unknown, was the device that ended up working extremely well. And, you know, it was also, aside from providing concrete situations that illustrated the principles, it was also way more engaging to read. So, you know, over the course of about three drafts, it turned from something that was much closer in tone and format to meditations or other self-epistolary material, and into more of a short story. And I think the balance, I'm really happy with how it turned out.
Awesome. So you created both a hardcover or physical book, right? A ebook, a Kindle copy.
Yep.
As well as an audio. So which one came first, Josh?
For Hydra?
Yeah, for Hydra.
So I actually published all three of them simultaneously. So I did the classic publishing launch of let's release the book in all three standard majored formats at the same time.
Well, So was there a strategy behind that, or was that just what felt right, or what was your thoughts on that? Because I've seen a couple of my friends that have, their goal has been to release the Kindle first, get mm-hmm. that to number one, get a bunch of reviews, and then release then the hardcover to keep kind of that, or to keep the, or the, you know, the physical copy to keep the drip going, and then eventually release the audio to kind of keep the launch interest for 9 months. What was your thought process there?
Yeah. So I think my goal in this particular book launch is that my first two books, you know, came from a very traditional process, working with a big company, doing all of the traditional publishing things. And the thing that I learned in that process, or one of the things that I learned in that process, is you can't really predict what the breakdown between volume preferences on each of the formats is going to be in advance. And so just, you know, rough off the top of the head numbers, Personal MBA did extremely well in print. So something like, you know, 70%+ of unit volume between print and ebook. And then the audio for Personal MBA did extremely well as well, which, you know, if you are in the traditional publishing world and someone says, okay, we have a 450-page, essentially business encyclopedia, how well is that going to do an audiobook? The answer is like probably not very well at all. It's just, it's not the type of book that seems like it'd do well in audio, where audio is probably, I'd have to tell, but if it's not the most successful format, it's close between print and audio. And so for First 20 Hours, 60% of the volume was in ebook. And so I found it really hard to anticipate what Hydra was going to do well in. And one of my personal goals, since this is the first book that I am publishing independently, one of my goals was to do it as professionally as I possibly could. And so it's very common in professionally published books that all three formats are available on launch day. And so I set that as a goal for myself. And, you know, time will tell. In terms of for Hydra, I expect audio to do really well because it's a story. And then it's interesting to see the breakdown. It seems like Kindle is extremely popular for fiction material, and it looks like the numbers are breaking that way, but it's early days. And so I think publishing simultaneously in all three formats, that gives you better information about what market demand looks like right now. So if people can get it in any format they want, which formats do they prefer? And then how does that break down, you know, on the business profit and loss sense, like what are the most profitable formats, and then what do you invest in for future books, things like that?
Wow. All really, really good questions. I think that's really a lot to think about. Now your book, when I look on your website, the book looks like it's square, but I'm going to guess that's meant to be like an audio CD, because when I look on Amazon at the paperback, it looks like it's probably a 5.5x8 book. But is that right, or is that, again, I'm curious a little more of the behind in your mind here. What is the strategy behind that, or is it just to be typical
yeah.
Book?
So on my site, I think I used the square format just because it looked better.
Cool.
And it fit the design. But then if you go to the Hydra website, all of the different formats are given equal billing. So and then in terms of paperback format, print on demand is a wonderful thing. You know, not having to worry about pre-orders several months in advance of the book, so you don't run out of copies. Demand planning, inventory, warehouse, shipping, all of that stuff. Print on demand is such a fantastic innovation in publishing. And, you know, frankly, I think a lot of the large publishers would be well suited to developing these sorts of capabilities. I mean, I have seen many, many, many book launches over the years by friends and colleagues and people I know that has essentially been ruined by not printing enough books because demand was higher than expected. It happens all the time. Actually, there was just a couple days ago, I think, a post by David Hennemeyer Hansen at Basecamp about their latest book. I'll send you this link so if people want to read it. But it, the title of the post is "Our Book Launch Was Botched and It's Been Crazy at Work Trying to Fix It." And the root of it is the publisher just didn't print enough copies, and they went out of stock on Amazon, and people couldn't buy it in the format that they wanted to buy it.
Wow.
So yeah, I mean, it's really nice. So you know, for the print version of Hydra, the book is physically small. It's 4x6. So literally pocket sized, which is, there's something about small books that I really like. It's very clear. One of the things that early readers have really liked about Hydra is it's a book that is easy to sit down and go through the entire book in a single sitting. It's about 45 minutes to an hour, depending on how fast you read. And so, you know, the book is, you know, 4x6, very small. And being able to publish that around the world. I mean, I clicked a button and it was available worldwide in about 48 hours. And I don't have to demand plan. So I don't have to go to, you know, a large commercial printer like Thompson Shore or, you know, one of the other professional printers and, you know, figure out how many thousands of copies of a book I need to print and how long is that going to take and what warehouse am I shipping to? And how are the sales going to happen? And how do I calculate sales tax? And, you know, all of those very important but time-consuming and soul-sucking things that you need to do to run a traditional retail business. Print-on-demand essentially abstracts that away. So it's not something that I need to think about on a day-to-day basis. And that enough, or that is enough to make it a really grand thing that I really, really like.
That's cool. Yeah, I completely agree with that, Josh. I've self-published 5 of my books, and it is way easier to use print on demand than it is to use anything else. But I gotta ask, so now that you've done both, mm-hmm. do you think you're ever gonna go back and traditionally publish, or are you gonna stick in the self-publishing?
Difficult to say at this point. So there is a lot about independent publishing that I really, really like. So for me in this, I was involved at every single step of the publishing process. And so the finished product, both in print and ebook, or in print and ebook and in audio, is essentially, I handled all of the details myself, down to the typesetting. Wow. And so it was a great experience from the perspective of, you know, imagining this thing that I want to exist in the world and working on it over the course of months to make the end result as close to what I was imagining as I possibly could. And so just being able to control all of those bits and pieces, I personally find interesting and rewarding. You know, even down to, There's something that if you want to submit your book to the Library of Congress, there's a way to do that. They give you a control number. You literally put a copy of your book in the mail to the Library of Congress, and they will catalog it appropriately. And then you can use that information to go to another company to establish what's called a PCIP record, PCIP. Which is, if you open a book and you look at the copyright page, that big block of text about, you know, what is this book? What's the ISBN? What's the Library of Congress control number? Where do you shelve it? All of that stuff. There are companies that you can hire and send the book to generate that record for you. And then if that book is either purchased or donated to a public library, there's a database that that library can pull from. And the record is already made and ready to put into the library acquisition system. And so that's the kind of thing that when you work with a traditional publisher, you don't have to think about, because the publisher just has something that does that, or somebody who does that for all of their books. But just being able to peek behind the scenes of all of the things that go into publishing a book in a professional way I really enjoyed the entire process of doing that. The thing that you give up by not going to a traditional publisher, two big things, essentially. The first is the advance, which depending on how you write, can be really important, right? So it's essentially a guaranteed return for investing your time and energy in making this book exist. And sometimes authors really need that advance because it essentially underwrites their capacity while they're creating the book. So independent publishing, no advance. So it's much riskier and less profitable in the short term because you don't have that guaranteed sum of money coming in. And then distribution in bookstores is something that is possible if you go through a distributor or things like that. But if you use print on demand, you're using a fundamentally different system. And so, you know, not being able to go into Barnes & Noble and, you know, see a copy of the book on the shelf, depending on how important that is to you, it's something that definitely going this route, you make a trade-off on. And so, you know, the way that I'm thinking about it right now is it really depends on the project and the goals of the project. And so for future projects, I am absolutely happy to talk to the folks I know at major publishing houses to see if it works. And if it's something that I want to have a greater level of flexibility and control and creativity and, you know, trying a bunch of new stuff because I want to try a bunch of new stuff, then independent publishing is a really great way to go. So all depends on what you want and why.
Fantastic. So, well, so many more ways we could go, Josh, but let's kind of bring this home here. If you've got advice for any aspiring authors out there that are thinking, you know what, I think I've got a book, but I don't know that I've done much yet. Where would you have them start with their book thoughts or even with their book journey?
So two things. The first is a general impression of what the writing process has looked like for me over the past several books. You never really know where a book is going to end up until after you've already worked on it for a while. And what really makes or breaks a book, in my experience, is the structure that you use to create it. And so I remember for Personal MBA, I was writing a book and I had no idea how to write a book. So this was all brand new to me. And I ended up going through, I think it was 10 different iterations of, like, not necessarily the content in the book, but the structure of the book that I was going to use to explain those ideas. And, you know, trying something and it wouldn't work and blowing it up and trying again. That was a very instructive process because, you know, if you think back to, you know, high school English classes or writing classes where they had you write an outline for a 5-page paper and you don't need an outline for a 5-page paper and it feels like a really, you know, big waste of time. Those types of skills become much, much, much more important when you're writing a book length project. And so really paying attention to the structure of the book, the structure of your argument, how you're breaking things down and what chunks you're using and when you introduce things. That to me is the core of nonfiction. Once you get that, the rest of the writing is much easier, but figuring out the best structure for the material and for the topic is the most important thing to focus on at the beginning. The second, and I think which comes to selecting projects is probably the best way to put it. My best advice is never write a book that you are not willing to read yourself at least 20 times. Because from start to finish, if you're doing it in a professional way, that's probably what it's going to take. And so there's this distinctive moment. And it's usually, you know, in the last push to get to the manuscript lock standpoint. Like the parts of writing the book are done and you're kind of getting ready to shift over into production. there will be a point in time where, you know, as you're writing this, you're like, oh man, I'm really sick of this. I've read it through so many times. I'm ready to be doing something else. I think it helps to understand that that is normal and is actually a good sign that you're going back over the same material over and over and over again. It helps bring the entire quality of the book up in a very substantial way. And so, you know, if you go into the process expecting it to be quick and easy, it is more difficult psychologically to persist long enough to see that book through to publication. Whereas if you go in saying, you know, I'm going to do a lot of experimentation. Some of the things that I'm going to try will not work. That's totally normal, part of the process. You're setting yourself up to have more realistic expectations of what the entire process looks like, and you're far more likely to actually finish the book and publish it.
Wow. So publishing, writing, hard work, worth it, I would say, but yeah, very hard work and something you should not take lightly. Understand it's going to be a lot of work going in, that you should be ready, willing, and able to read your own book at least 20 times, or otherwise don't think about writing it. Is that a good way to wrap that up, Josh?
Yeah. You know, it's by way of metaphor, it's writing a book is the cognitive equivalent of an ultra marathon. Like it's a sustained psychological effort for a very long period of time. And, you know, versus running, which is a physical challenge, writing a book is a mental and emotional challenge, but it is hard in the same ways. And so if you just understand that this goes with the territory of doing this work, and the work is worth it and will reward your dedication and persistence, then you should absolutely create the best material that you possibly can. I mean, I can't think of anything else in this world that has a higher value to other people in the world at large than taking everything that you have learned the hard way over the years, or the things that you have discovered that worked really well for you, and putting it into a book form that potentially, you know, tens, hundreds of thousands, hopefully millions of people can benefit from. And, you know, doing that in a way that allows the things that you have learned to be broadly accessible to the widest possible audience. You know, books are fantastic in that regard. So it's good work. It's important work. It's valuable work. Persistence and dedication and seeing it through to the end is the best thing that you can possibly do.
That's a great way to wrap it up, Josh. I appreciate all that insight today. Holy crap. Lots of stuff about publishing, about writing, and about persisting, and maybe even about how to fight a hydra. So, Josh Kaufman, I appreciate you, man. If folks want to get more of your awesome, they can go to Josh Kaufman. That's KAUFMAN.net. Check that out. Or howtofightahydra.com from Josh's new book, How to Fight a Hydra, Face Your Fears, Pursue Your Ambitions, and Become the Hero You're Destined to Be. Josh, it's been a pleasure to talk to you today, man. Thank you so much for your time.
Phil, this has been so much fun. It's great to chat with you once again.
Absolutely.